It's time for Mac Geek Gab, and listener JMM brings us our quick tip of the week with, hey, you fellow geeks, I just discovered that one of the recent iOS updates, the Files app now lets you scan documents with a long press. All you have to do is long press the Files app icon. A menu pops up with the option to scan right at the top. So you can scan your document right then and there. No need to open the app and dig through menus anymore. More tips like this, plus your questions answered today on Mac Geek Gab number 1074 for Monday, January 27th, 2025.
Bubble Wrap Appreciation Day, and welcome to Mac Geek Gab. We are the show where you send in your tips like that. We share them. You send in your cool stuff found. We share that too. You send in your questions. We try to answer those, as well as sharing the questions. Really, the goal is to put all this together so that we can each learn at least five new things every single time we get together. Our sponsor for today is Otherworld Computing, and we'll talk a little bit more about their new Thunderbolt 5 hub in a few minutes. For now, here in Anaheim, California, right next to the Anaheim, sandwiched between the Anaheim Convention Center and Disneyland, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in South Dakota, I'm Adam Christensen.
And here in New Hampshire, it's Pilot Pete. Good to be back with you guys today. We're police code 1074. Like I said, Dave, they're getting morbider and morbider. This is an unattended death. Hopefully this show won't kill you and we won't die on air.
I'm pretty sure 1074 is also a smoke report. So maybe we'll go with that one. Maybe
let's go with we'll that go because with that. There's plenty of that where you are these days, Dave.
So, that's true. That's true. You know, yeah.
Hearts go out to all the people suffering.
No kidding.
Just devastating.
Yeah. It's
my mind went to a better kind of smoke, but that's okay.
Right on.
There's a lot. I've encountered more of that here than I have the other kind of smoke here in Anaheim anyway. But yeah, no, there are people who have obviously lost everything, and it's terrible. It's terrible. Yeah. I'm here for the NAMM conference. I'm putting myself on the spot. North American Music Merchants Conference. But really what it is it's just Mecca for the music industry, the annual conference here in Anaheim. And so there's so many people from LA in that business, and so many of them have just lost so much, but yeah, it's, crazy.
Yeah, it's terrible. Terrible. Yeah. And again, I mentioned to you guys that it was one of the bullet items on our list for a lot of people ask why we left California and dealing with the fires. It's a real thing. It is a real thing, and it's a real part of life in California there now. So especially Southern California.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I don't know how to transition from that.
That's a real downer.
Sorry.
It is. No,
it's bad stuff.
Like I know people who have lost their homes. Anything we can do to help them, and maybe just kind of doing what we do and giving everybody a sense of normalcy would be a good thing. So that is my transition. Yep. Make sure though to register for the monthly giveaway. With the hats that we're giving away this month at MacGeekUp.com/giveaway. And with that, Kirshen tells us about it. I don't know if it was a reminder. Tells us we had our MacGeekUp hangout in the past week. I can't remember what day it is. That's it.
It was Sunday afternoon.
Yep. Yeah. And Kirshen reminded all of us in the hangout that if you go to the terminal and you type last reboot with a space between last and reboot, so all lowercase, the words the way they sound, it will show you all recent shutdowns and reboots that have happened on your Mac. So if you're wondering, okay, well, you know, how recently have I rebooted? You can do that with just one command called uptime, which will show you how long your Mac's been up But if you want to see a history of recent reboots, Last Space Reboot will show you shutdowns and reboots. So, and it will articulate the difference between the two of them.
Now, Dave, correct me if I'm wrong. Did we validate that you had to be admin to get that to work?
That is correct. You have to be an admin user in order for that to work. Yes. Yes. You don't need to have, you don't need to use the sudo command to see it, but you do have to be a user who could, I think is really where that comes from. So,
yeah. Got it.
Yeah.
Cool. Cool.
Yep. You got our next one, Adam?
Hey, yeah. So, this is something that took me far too long to figure out. And this is for any of you out there who use a password manager, like a third-party password manager. I use 1Password, but I think you can integrate a number of them into your browsers and things like that. And you maybe also use Apple's now, they call it password, but this was an issue under iCloud Keychain or whatever. It didn't matter. So if you were using both of them, I'd be in a browser and I'd be trying to log into a website or something like that. And basically both dialogues would pop up. So I'd get the 1Password dialogue and then right on top of that, the Apple dialogue. And I was doing this caveman thing where it's like, well, I want the one that's in 1Password because, you know, some websites I have multiple different logins for and what have you. And so a lot of them are in 1Password, not all of them are in Apple Password. So I'm doing this weird jigging thing and I'm trying to like scroll underneath and find the one to click on. And it's really difficult. Well, I finally figured out all you need to do is hit the escape key and the Apple one goes away. And then your third party one is there and available. Like, I don't know why it took me so long to figure that out, but
that's a
little trick. Escape.
I have a tip to add to that, because in addition to passwords getting in the way of the 1Password thing, there's also a scenario where Apple's autofill wants to autofill one of my email addresses, not from my passwords or or 1Password, not from any of those, but just, you know, from my contacts, like, you know, my contact, it wants to fill that out. And that gets annoying too. What I have learned to do is, instead of putting my cursor in the field for my email or username when I want to fill out a password, I put my cursor on the password field. And then it doesn't try to give me an email address there, because it knows that an email address doesn't belong there. And at least at that point, all I'm contending with is, which password manager do I want to let it use? And if you're only using 1Password manager, then this would then make your life even easier, because you go to the password field and now all you're getting are options for passwords, not some autofill thing trying to overdo it. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Diablo.
I think I'm going to get myself in trouble now, because I think there is somewhere in settings, right, where you can tell it which ones you want. So you could, even if you know you have everything in a single password manager.
Yes.
I forget where that setting is now. You could it's probably under Touch ID and passwords, maybe? Or privacy? I can't remember where it is. That's, like I said, I'm getting myself in trouble. But I know there is a setting somewhere where you can tell it, hey, I have these password managers. Use Apple's, use 1Password, use both. There's checkboxes somewhere in the system.
Certainly on your Mac, if you go into Safari Preferences Autofill, here there is an option for usernames and passwords, and that is Apple's usernames and passwords. So on my laptop, I currently have that turned off, so the only thing that functions is 1Password. And then the way I get 1Password to function is with the extension in the same settings panel. Well, you move over to the pane for extensions and I turn that on or off, and then that usually works. But yeah, you're right, on your phone there's a different place, and I can't look it up because A, I'm using my phone as my camera, and B, I've had like 3.5 hours of sleep, so you know. 9 a.m. Eastern recording sounds really good when you're on the East Coast.
Los Angeles.
That's right. That is correct.
But at least you were only up till 3, so you know.
I mean, yeah.
Eastern.
3 Eastern. That's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. So. Yeah. That's kind of how it works. these things. It's okay.
So real quick, before we move on to the next tip, then I want you both to look into the future and tell me, will passwords, Apple's built in, ever Sherlock 1Password? Because I'd love to wean off 1Password, but secure notes and identities and credit cards and all that are so convenient in 1Password.
Well, so a lot of that has already been, to use the term Sherlocked, a lot of that already is in Apple Passwords, right?
I just haven't played with it enough.
Correct. Your credit cards for sure are in there, and those fill very well. Notes, you would have, if you want secure notes, you'd have to use the Notes app for that. Yeah. But in terms of most of the stuff that 1Password does, Apple Passwords has it. The identities thing is probably the one that that I don't think,
because like
there's,
I have
an analog for
photos of my driver's license attached to identities, my passport, all that in there. So that,
I mean, you could do that in a note, right?
Yeah, there's, fair enough.
You could certainly approximate that, and I know plenty of people who have. So and I think keeping a copy of your passport, a picture of your passport, and a picture of your driver's license on your some system that is synced with your phone, so that you just always have access to it. I can't imagine it would ever be a bad thing. It might not save you the way you'd want it to save you if you forgot the actual document, but I can't imagine it would be a bad thing to be able to show that and say, well, here's this. Can we work with it?
Yes. I can tell you, I know from friends who have lost their passports in foreign countries, those that did not have any documentation as to who they were in a real bad sandwich. And those who had a photo of it were at least able to demonstrate to the consulate, really, my picture, that's me. How about helping me out here? And things went much smoother for them. So.
Yep. Yep.
So there's your quick tip. Keep a photo of your driver's license, passport, all that on your phone. Even if you get, how many times you've gone out without your wallet and not without your phone, though?
Right.
You're pulled over by the cops. You go, whoops. Yeah, but here I am. You know, will they let you go driving without a license? Maybe, maybe not.
Right. But it's not going to make it worse. It might make it better.
It's not going to make it worse.
Yes. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right. So I want to go on to our next quick tip. And that last week I was trying to fill in or create a new account, and it wanted a password. And it let me cut and paste because I was using 1Password, and I had this really long, complicated, random password generated, good to go. And then the confirmation field, I almost threw my laptop out the window. It would not let me paste. And how are you going to get a more accurate confirmation than by pasting what's up there, right? I mean, you're going to make a mistake typing it far over pasting. So happened to wander across Stephen A's tip in Discord that says fool websites that block pasting data such as passwords. I'm like, oh, he read my mind. Can we put the photo of that in the or the screenshot of that in the show notes, Dave? Is there a way to do that?
No, but if Stephen posted in Discord, we can
link to it.
We can link to it.
That's how we'll do it. Yeah, we'll link to that then. So he uses Keyboard Maestro to type a data field, which was brilliant. So what you do is you paste, you know, your password into that. It comes up and says, hey, what do you want to put in there? And you paste it into that field, and Keyboard Maestro then types what you've pasted into it, into that field. And then Porthos John goes, oh, you can also do it with a shortcut in Apple Script. So that's also in that same theme. Belt and suspenders kind of guy, I created the shortcut, and I also created the Keyboard Maestro. Because with Keyboard Maestro, I think I did comma V as the keystroke to pull it up, and Option Command V for the shortcut to get it to come up, because Command V is paste, right?
Sure.
So Option Command V is the shortcut version, and Keyboard Maestro is comma V to get it to come up. So
I I have an addendum or perhaps an enhancement of this. Instead of having it ask me for what text I want it to type as opposed to paste, I have it do it. I have a similar keystroke that takes whatever is on the clipboard and types it out into the text field. So it's already right there.
I do too. That's what that does for you. I forgot. My bad.
There you go.
It's already in there. That way. Yeah.
Got it. All right. Yep.
Yeah. So I'm so new to it. I haven't figured it out yet. That's what I'm actually doing.
I think.
My story and I'm stuck with it.
I have memory of this being a default macro in Keyboard Maestro when I first got it. This whole type clipboard thing was an example macro in there. I don't have recollection of creating it, but it's certainly there and it's called type clipboard. But maybe I created it. I don't know what. I've had 3.5 hours of sleep. Don't listen to me, says the podcaster. Please listen to me. Please subscribe.
Right on.
That the other thing that sometimes works, if Command V won't let you paste in those fields, is right click in the field or control click in the field and choose from the drop down paste. That will sometimes work in those scenarios too.
So, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
Moving on.
Yeah. Gary has a great tip for us. He said, I hadn't ever thought about it before last night, but I was recording some video of my buddy's band performance. I set my iPhone 16 Pro Max on a tripod and stepped out of the way. I knew which songs to record. As I was about 20 feet away, it came to mind I'd heard something about using Apple Watch to control the camera app. So I scrolled through the apps on my Apple Watch, and lo and behold, I found it. I was able to start and stop the recording, switch between front and back cameras, and I was seeing what the camera was seeing. How cool is that? And I would say that is very cool. This is a feature that I have actually personally used as well from time to time. And it's great. It's easy. It's one of those ones that I think is kind of a little bit easy to forget about. When I usually remember it is when same situation, I'm out with my family. There's no one around to ask to take a photo of us, and I want to prop up the thing or find a tripod or whatever. And then you can bring that up and, stealthily, with your arm down, just tap the little button on your Apple Watch and take the picture rather than having to do the whole timed thing where you're trying to like hit the button and like run around and get set up.
Second default.
Yeah.
When you hit the button, it gives you 3 seconds to drop your arm.
Yeah,
we're getting your muscle.
You can set it up different ways. Yeah, but it's super handy, and then you can make sure your shot's framed and the way you want it, and you're not having to be like looking back and forth.
Yeah,
so it's kind of nice.
That's great, nice.
Although I will say, I've tried to use it recently, and the trigger still works, but I am not seeing the picture on my Apple Watch, and I don't know why.
Really?
But, yeah.
Huh.
I've 2 or 3 times lately, so I'm gonna have to troubleshoot that a little bit and see what's up.
Yeah.
So,
if you know, feedback@macgeekgab.com.
Hold on. That's a great idea. Send it to feedback@macgeekgab.com if you've got that answer.
Easy for you to say. It's feedback@macgeekgab.com. So,
fair enough.
Yep.
So, all right. How about I take us to Jendal and his method? This was cool. I can't tell you. I've got a 64 gig iPad, and when I go on the road and I have a lot of movies on it and stuff like that, because on a 14-hour flight, there's times when you go in the back for several hours, watch a TV series, watch a movie, something like that. And when it comes time to update some of the software, it goes, oh, no, you don't have enough space. Not for you. And I'm deleting pictures and movies and stuff like that, defeating the purpose. Brilliant idea Jendal puts in the quick tips this week, says use a cable for software updates on iOS and iPad OS if the space is a problem. I wanted to update my iPad Air 5th generation M1 to iPad OS 18.2 to get all of the new goodies, but the iPad informed me I did not have enough space to upgrade. I had about 12 gigabytes available out of 64. I connected the iPad to my M1 Mac Mini, and when it appeared in the Finder sidebar, I clicked on it and selected Update. After some security verifications on the iPad, my Mac downloaded the iPad software, unlocked it, and then sent the upgrade to the iPad. I've used this technique in the past with my iPhone as well. I thought this tip might be useful to others as well, as the Apple Intelligence upgrades keep coming and there's never enough RAM.
Well, it's never enough storage, but yes.
Well, storage, yeah, yeah. But yeah.
I forget about this.
There's never enough RAM either. But,
there's never enough RAM. No. I forget about this too. Because I have very low storage iPads that I use like on stage for things. Sure. Because it doesn't matter how much storage they have. They just need to run the app until they also need to, you know, do an update. It's like, okay, I'm trying to make Sophie's choices here. It's like, do you want me to offload unused apps? And it's like 100% never do that. Like I need all these apps on here.
You may need that app.
Correct. When I don't have a Wi-Fi connection at a gig or something. So it's like, no.
You know how to guarantee you need that app?
Yeah.
Offload it.
That's the way. I know. Yeah, when they first rolled that feature out, it was on by default, and I get to a gig, and I'm like, oh, great, I just use the Allen and Heath app. Wait, why is it not here? Where did it go? Maybe today, not. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But the other advantage to that, I think, is it's a quick way to get a hardcore backup to your Mac. Mm-hmm. So if things go hinky, you've got a good backup of it right there without having to use Wi-Fi to restore. So.
Yep.
That's fair. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. My only recommendation on doing those backups is if you want your health data and your password data and all that stuff also backed up, make sure you turn on the encryption and put your encryption password key in your password manager so you have it next time you need to grab that.
Yes, that's a great tip. Without your backups being encrypted, your health data does not get backed up. Yep. Yep.
Yep.
I forgot about that. That's a great point. Oh,
yep.
Yep.
Just be careful.
Yep. Okay. Don't get caught.
All right. Scott has a follow-up for us, a little follow-up tip. He says, gents, in episode 1073, Pete mentioned the silence unknown callers function. It is, as he said, buried deep in the settings. Said there's a better way to get to it. I created two simple shortcuts labeled block unknown callers and allow unknown callers. They are a simple one-step shortcuts. I added a second step with a notification saying it is now on or off. And he sent us a screenshot of that that I think we'll link to, I would assume. Why is this better? Easy. Rather than digging into settings, if I want to allow unknown callers, like I'm anticipating a callback from someone not in my contacts, I just use the S lady to say, S lady, allow unknown callers. That's it. No need to search, find, scroll, or tap. I use it a lot, and once you've installed it, I'm sure you will too.
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I like that.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. One last quick tip, I believe, from Ferrer's here. This also came from our Hangout discussion that we had. If you are using a mouse that does not allow horizontal scroll, many mice have vertical scroll wheels. Nowadays, a lot of mice have horizontal scroll, but not all. And so if you're like me and you have a mouse that does not do horizontal scroll, if you hold down the shift key and do the vertical scroll, guess what happens? You now have horizontal scroll. I had no idea about this. It's life-changing for me in the studio. I don't know why I still use an old mouse. That it's just how things are up there. And but there's times when I need to do horizontal scroll. It's such part and parcel of how our Mac's user interface works these days that you need to do that. And so,
right.
Yep. So thank you to Ferrer's for solving that problem for me and maybe for some of us out there.
I went trackpad and I never went back.
I'm surprised that I haven't in the studio. I'm trackpad at my desk in the office. I'm obviously trackpad on my laptop because that's what's right there. And I have a first gen Magic trackpad, the one where you have to replace the batteries. And I have one of those, within arm's reach of me in the studio. And for whatever reason, I just, haven't worked it into my like podcast workflow up there, which is ridiculous. But it's, yeah.
There's controversy. I play on a Minecraft server with some friends, and there's two of us on that server who are Mac users and trackpad users, and we play Minecraft with the trackpad, and the rest of the group is just horrified. Absolutely horrified.
Because you're not using a mouse? Is that what they're horrified about?
It's probably not the best input for games and gaming. Yes, like you have a multi-button like gaming mouse or something like that. There's much more functionality. You could do things a lot faster. You could assign, you know, things to auto switch the it is arguably a better way to play Minecraft, but we're just trackpad people.
You're trackpad,
like, that's
people.
What we have and that's what we play. Yeah,
well, so. Certainly in an audio studio environment, the trackpad is so much better than a mouse because of all the horizontal scrolling that happens, that it's utterly ridiculous that I'm not using the trackpad in the studio.
Oh yeah. Zipping through the timeline. I use it for expanding and collapsing the timeline. Like, with the pinch. And
how I have lived without horizontal scroll or knowing how to do horizontal scroll is also just flabbergasting to me, but it is. It's just, I don't know. Yeah. Our minds are weird, right? Like, this reminds me of a scenario that I encountered many times when I was consulting. I would, you know, I had probably hundreds of clients throughout the city of Austin, certainly when I was down there. And occasionally I'd be driving somewhere or someone would call and be like, oh, I'm having a problem. Okay. Tell me what you're having. I can't remember what my password is for this thing. Do you happen to remember? And what I learned was in the moment that they asked me the question, I was like, I don't know. Like, you know, you're one of 150 people that I've saw in the last month or something. Like, I have no idea. But what I did learn was if I was driving, I would pull over and I would say, all right, I'm going to close my eyes, sit down at your computer and describe the environment. You know, tell me where the keyboard is, what's on the wall, this, that, and the other thing. And as soon as I got like a visual memory of their environment, I'd be like, oh, wait, I know what your password is. Like, yeah, okay. We're good to go. So our minds are weird.
There you go.
Yeah. Minds are weird.
You find it in that Rolodex, man.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. The mental Rolodex. Triggers. Yeah. Yep. I don't know where I was going with that. So,
Well, how about I take us to this week's Don't Get Caught segment?
I like it. Let's go.
All right. So, Ron writes in, and he's talking about a situation that happened to him. And I think this is more of a workaround than anything else, but here's what he wrote. Since installing Sequoia, I've noticed that passwords has become extremely problematic when I use autofill or attempt to change a login password. It's been an annoyance, but not severe enough to warrant immediate action. However, since Sequoia, it appears to be aggressively blocking the suggestions provided by 1Password. Even when I accessed the 1Password suggestions, I was unable to save the changes I made in the 1Password save dialog box. My 1Password extension was functioning correctly, but I simply couldn't save anything. Since I generally rely on 1Password as my primary password keeper, I decided to reach out to them for assistance. They promptly responded within 24 hours and suggested that I disable autofill for the usernames and passwords in the settings. Since implementing this change, everything has been working flawlessly. It seems that there has been a conflict between the 2Password apps since Passwords was introduced. I thought I'd share the solution in case anyone else is experiencing a similar issue. So yeah, he'd change it and go back, and it wasn't saved. And by disabling autofill,
I am assuming, and I might be misassuming or misinterpreting this, that he disabled the passwords, not one Apple autofill. Passwords autofill, not the 1Password autofill, which is the setting that we happened to mention earlier, right? In Safari, the autofill settings.
That would
make sense. That's why I did that on my laptop too, because I was just sick of it getting in the way. But I've thought about Safari? Moving everything away from 1Password, but yeah.
Safari autofill can be somewhat problematic. The thing we run into a lot just with, you know, I work for an e-commerce company, and we have a lot of instances sometimes when autofill will just like freak out and put autofill garbage in the wrong field. And some of that is web developer problems, because it's looking for specific like classes or IDs on fields and things like that to kind of indicate or what kind of field it is. But sometimes too, it just like really screws up, and we'll get like complaints about it put, you know, the state in the address line, and somebody didn't realize it. Right. Yeah. And then they submitted the, it's like, we can't ship the thing because we don't know where it's supposed to go.
That's fun. That's fun.
Yeah. Always double check. The point is, when you're placing orders online, always double check when you get to that review screen that it has the right. I've made that mistake. I think that's another don't get, just to add, don't get caught. I've gotten caught sending something. As a matter of fact, a coworker did this. I got makeup at my house one day, and I thought, oh my God, did one of my daughters accidentally send it? You know, cause that happens, cause they're away now. They've gone off to college. And I thought, maybe they sent it here. And I was like looking at it, and I'm like, no. And then I got this random text like a week later from a previous coworker, and she goes, did you get a package of mine? Cause they had sent me like a like thank you gift for something I had done. And it was on Shopify. And that was the address that was the last time she used Shopify. And then like years later, she just placed this other order with another Shopify company, and it just auto-filled and got sent to me. So always when you get to that review screen right before you hit purchase, check your shipping and your billing address and make sure everything is okay.
All right, folks, let's talk about the future of connectivity. And no, I'm not talking about some sci-fi brain link. Not yet. I am talking about the new OWC Thunderbolt 5 hub. I just got to see it in action at CES, of course, and the thing's going to be a game changer, right? It's like they took all my connectivity dreams, added a dash of absurd speed, and wrapped it in a sleek aluminum package that stays as cool as the other side of the pillow. This hub gives you up to 80 gigabits per second of bidirectional speed, and get this, up to 120 gigabits per second for your display setups. We're talking up to 3 8K displays. Three! It's like having your own personal IMAX theater, but, you know, for coding, gaming, or scrolling memes. And you can daisy chain devices like a connectivity wizard. And it delivers up to 140 watts of power to your laptop or whatever, right? If you need to charge a MacBook and, I don't know, a small robot army, no problem. And hey, don't get caught fumbling with compatibility. This works with Thunderbolt 5, Thunderbolt 4, Thunderbolt 3, USB 4, and USB-C devices. Basically, if it's got a port, this hub's got you covered. Check it out now at macsales.com. OWC, our sponsor, and where connectivity meets cool. And remember, folks, don't get caught without it. And our thanks to OWC for sponsoring this episode.
All right, shall we do some questions here?
Yeah, I think Andrew has one for us. He says, my question relates to the laptop battery management app Al Dente by App House Kitchen and whether it's worth installing. Or is it better to rely on Apple's own battery health management? Both claim to improve battery longevity by allowing the battery to discharge and waiting till you need it to fully charge it. The theory behind not leaving the battery charged at 100% is not in question, just whether Al Dente does it better. I've read online conflicting reports by users. Some say it has preserved battery health, some say it made no difference, and some say it made their battery worse. Well, that's super helpful. The problem is that if a person has only one MacBook Pro, it's impossible to know whether Al Dente was helpful or not, or useless or harmful. It's hardly a controlled experiment. Any wisdom you can provide would be really appreciated.
So I can double your set of anecdotal evidence, Andrew, because I have two laptops that I manage here in the Hamilton household. I mean, there's more. My kids both have them, but they manage their own laptops mostly. But my laptop is not my daily driver. It is one that I use clearly here when I'm traveling. I also use it on the couch. I probably do use it every day, but it is not my primary machine. And then my wife has a laptop that she has made her primary machine when she's at her desk. It is plugged in to monitors and keyboards and all those things. And then when we travel, she just grabs it and takes it with her, which she really likes. But hers is certainly at greater risk of battery overcharging because it's plugged in all the time, except for when we travel. And that's a really bad time to find out that you've done terrible things to your battery right before you go on a trip. So on hers, I use Al Dente on hers, and I have it set to stop the battery from charging at 70%. I don't know how the magic works, but even though it's plugged in, the Mac says, no, I'm done charging. It's 70%. And Al Dente is doing that. Apple's tech doesn't let you be that restrictive about things. It's a little more fluid in the way that it manages stuff. And I feel better using Al Dente to stop it at 70. And then, of course, I can set it before we go on a trip. You know, we change it and say, okay, now let it go to 100 and it'll charge up to 100 and do it for the trip. And then when the trip's over, you know, we pull it back. So I can say that on hers, battery longevity has been good. And I can also say that on my laptop, without running Al Dente, battery longevity has been good. I don't know if this is helpful. I think this is the problem, right? There is no, as far as I know, and maybe the folks at App House Kitchen, when they hear this, will have more things to say, but I don't know of any truly long-term controlled experiments other than the wide set of users using Al Dente as one big data set. But I don't know if or what type of data App House Kitchen collects on that, if there's any sort of aggregated data. So I don't know, but that's what I do.
I can maybe speak to the other side a little bit, and okay, then I have a question for you guys. So I can tell you that I basically use my laptop like a desktop, and it's in, I mentioned it's an old Intel machine, 2019 MacBook okay. Pro, I think. Yeah. 16 inch, if I'm remembering the year right. But I leave mine plugged in all the time, and I can tell you my battery life has been obliterated, basically.
Yeah.
So it's a 16 inch 2019 MacBook Pro. Now, here's my question, because I went to check battery health, and Apple says it's normal. It's definitely not normal. Like, if I unplug that thing, it will last. I'm lucky if I get an hour out of it, probably hour and a half. Yeah. And I'm not doing anything heavy. I'm not, you know, it's like, so I know it needs a new battery. I mean, age of it also, it just needs a new battery. It's freaking 2019 sure. machine, right?
Yeah, right.
But the battery has been destroyed for a long time. So I always use it plugged in, so it doesn't matter. So I can say that. My question is the Apple's battery management, because I went into the battery settings, I looked at options. I don't see that I have any option to limit. Is it just automatic, supposedly, that Apple's managing your battery life, and that's why we need a tool like Al Dente?
Kind of. It's different for every Mac.
Okay, that was...
Yeah, that makes sense. That battery preference pane evolves, adapts to whatever type of Mac you have and what battery smarts are in it. But I have seen, we have all seen, options go away. Like, you might, when that 2019 came out, you may have had more granular options in whatever, you know, energy saver, whatever it was called at the time. But right. the predecessor of that preference pane probably had more granular options for you when you got that Mac than it does today in Sequoia. Like, if you go back to the Mac OS 15, if you go back to the version of Mac OS, you probably have different options. However, go ahead.
I may have found it. I think it's a buried thing.
I don't
know why. So that little battery health thing that says normal, next to it is the little eye icon. I click that, and I get additional options, and it says battery condition, and then it says optimized battery charging, which is on, manage battery longevity, which is on. So there you go.
Okay, so see, on mine, I don't get manage battery longevity. I get battery condition, maximum capacity, which mine is telling me is 90%, which isn't terrible, but not great. And I get optimized battery charging if I want that. And then that's that. So,
yep.
Yeah.
So it is a little bit different, but yeah, it's on, it's hidden under that little normal. I hate the new system settings. They're just so
I would terrible. Be curious because optimized battery charging is the, you know, it's sort of one size fits all switch to do effectively the same thing that, that al dente does at a much more controlled and granular level. I would be curious. So that what that does, the optimized battery charging apples, is it gets you to 80% and then waits until it decides you need to charge up to 100 before you're ready to go for the day. And it presumably uses some sort of, you know, historical data about your usage of your Mac to make that decision. All this makes sense. What I'm curious is for someone like you, Adam, that has a machine that's plugged in all of the time, how frequently does it go to 100%? Is it still going like once a day, like our phones would, right? You know, our phones get to 80% overnight if we have optimized charging on. And then, you know, an hour before we are going to wake up, it tops us off to 100 and we're off to the races. That makes sense for a phone where you're actually using it on battery every day. But if your computer is not being used on battery every day, does it know to only maybe go up to 100 once a week? Somebody out there knows this answer, right? And that would be helpful to know.
I can tell you in the last 24 hours, it was plugged in and at 100% battery from midnight till 3 a.m. or so. And then it started to go down. That was yesterday afternoon. So at 12 noon yesterday, it was at 100% plugged in and charging. Then it went down and I did it. It was plugged in the entire time because it was sitting on a shelf plugged in. So then it let it looks like it let it drain down till about 6 p.m.
Fascinating.
And then it charged it back up, likely because during the day I'm not using it. I'm at work using my
work
thing
laptop.
And and then I'm likely to come at night and start using it again. Right. So it's probably watched my pattern of usage and decided, because I think that's how that feature is supposed to work.
Decided,
he might pick up and unplug his laptop at around 6 p.m. So, or 7 p.m., 8 p.m. I'm going to charge it up and then it'll be ready to go. The other thing I'll mention about that other setting that you said you don't have, the manage battery longevity, that may come up as your laptop ages, I'm thinking, because that's the one where as your battery gets older, it will reduce the overall max capacity. So my battery will not actually charge to 100% of its full capacity. It starts lowering. So 100% is not 100%, which is probably also a condition of why it doesn't last as long.
It's not using as much of the battery, right?
Yeah.
So, interesting.
There you go.
Yeah. So I'd be curious what that graph looks like for someone who truly just leaves it plugged in all the time. And I, as I'm saying this, I realize, you know, Dave, you could do that experiment with Lisa's computer, because what better computer to experiment with in your house than Lisa's?
Than your wife's. Yeah.
So. Can you spell divorce attorney?
Nope. The only time I would need to do that. Well, the only time that's a realistic version for us where I would need to do that is, and she's made it very clear, if I ever book a surprise party for her, make sure that, two divorce attorneys are the first two guests on the list. She does not like surprise parties. So bring two divorce attorneys and anybody else you'd like to invite. Yep. But that's okay. We learn how to live with each other. It's wonderful.
Right on.
Like, I know this. See, you're
trainable.
We are all trainable. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Absolutely. I don't know where we are on any of this. Now I'm lost.
Valentine's question.
Go ahead.
Valente, Valentine.
I don't know which way it is. I got it. Longtime listener, I found your advice incredibly helpful over the years. Amazing. Thank you for saying that, Valentine. I wanted to reach out for some guidance on choosing the best Thunderbolt hub available. I previously used a CalDigit TS3 Plus, which unfortunately broke after 4 years. Currently, I have the Anchor 14-in-1 hub, which is more budget-friendly and offers similar functionality, but I've noticed that only one of the USB ports is high speed. I'm wondering if you could recommend a more reliable Thunderbolt hub that offers robust performance and maybe more high-speed ports. Any suggestions would be greatly appreciated.
So I answered this, and now my new answer is go back a couple minutes and listen to...
Well, OWC's Thunderbolt 5 hub is probably not the thing for this part of Valentine's Thunderbolt management. The Thunderbolt 5 hub is more for distributing out all of your stuff and then connecting things with more ports to it from there.
Right. So, but my answer back to him was that first of all, he talked about his budget. And I said, you don't mention what budget friendly means, because one man's budget is another man's extravagance.
Yeah,
but
it's fair.
But in that light, I offered, look, there's I've never had, knocking some wood here, a bad product from OWC along those lines. And they've got a Thunderbolt 11 port Thunderbolt dock that's I want to say it was $279. Now I've lost the price point on that, but we'll put the link in the show notes. Three Thunderbolt 4 ports, four USB 3 ports, Ethernet, audio, and a card reader. And it looks like something that might do the job for his question. Thoughts, Adam, Dave?
Yeah, there is also, and I just want to say, obviously, OWC is a sponsor, it turns out, of this particular episode, and certainly has been a sponsor of the show for a long time. That has nothing to do with... The only way that our recommendations are related to their sponsorship is in reverse. They decided to sponsor the show after we had been recommending their products for so long that the recommendations are and have always been our recommendations and are not anything anyone has purchased. That said, there is also a 14 port Thunderbolt hub from OWC that has... I'm looking at the speeds of these ports.
There was something about that I didn't recommend that. And I don't remember what it was.
No, that makes sense. Yeah. Well, because the 11 port
maybe
one.
The price.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't even look at the price. The 11 port one has the ability to do Thunderbolt 4 hubbing, whereas the 14 port one is about Thunderbolt pass through. But again, if you don't need hubbing and yet you need more ports to do things with, and you know, using the 14 port one as the end of the line might be what you want. You really, and this is why I love the dongle world that we get to live in now, where we each get to choose the dongle, and I realize that a Thunderbolt hub is sort of a fixed in place dongle, but it's a dongle nonetheless that we just hang off of our Mac. We each get to pick what ports we're going to have. And we could all go buy the same Mac and then set them up very differently, because with dongles, we get to use, our own subset of ports. So it really depends. I would agree with you, Pete. OWC is a great way to go and look at their offerings and pick the one that makes sense for you. And it might not even be a Thunderbolt hub. You might want just a USB hub if that is going to serve your needs. There's no wrong answer here other than the answer that doesn't serve your needs.
Right. Exactly.
So,
yeah, to that end, I might have something to add. And keep in mind, I am a huge fan of Anchor. And I know he mentioned he had one of the versions of the Anchor. I think he has the newer one. I have the Power Expand Elite 13-in-1 Thunderbolt 3 dock. And it's been mostly great. The one thing to consider about stuff like this is the orientation of the dock. So the OWC one is a nice long one that sits flat on the desk. This is one of the more vertical ones. And I don't know that I would ever go with a vertical dock again. And the reason why is the strain it puts on specifically Thunderbolt cables. So the cable comes out and then hangs straight down, which tends to want to pull the cable down. And so I've had issues where I bump the desk and it literally is enough. There's enough leverage on that because there's enough play. And one thing I, you know, in the USB-C connector that I don't like is versus what we had with FireWire back in the day is there's a lot more play in that connector. So a lot of times it's just enough to just for a brief moment, disconnect the connection and then all things go haywire. And then everything kind of comes back. So I'm on a Zoom call and my video goes away, or I'm, you know, doing an audio thing and my mic goes away. Like, it becomes super annoying. Luckily, OWC has a solution for that that did help. They have these little, I forget what they're called. They're little stick-on, screw-in attachments that basically lock your USB-C cable in place. And so I bought those. They got a little 3M sticky on it. You put it around it. I'm trying to remember what they're called now.
It's called the OWC Klingon. Klingon. Yes.
Yeah. So that kind of solved the problem, but just something to consider when you're looking at that orientation. I think the USB, you know, obviously the wider way, I think they're a little more supported than the vertical way in terms of just wobble and wiggle and play. So
that's interesting. I have a CalDigit dock somewhere in my setup that is built to be stood up vertically like you're describing. And I also have the Anchor one somewhere in my setup. I think I have that, one of those in my office. And I also have found that same issue where they want to fall out sideways kind of. But with the two that I have, you can lay the docks on their side.
Yeah, I don't know. I think this one has, I've looked at it and you probably could, but I think it has cooling vents on either side of it. So I worry about, because it does get also super hot. That's the other thing that I often wondered if it was actually overheating, because it will get really, really warm. And I don't know if it has fans in it or not, which may be another thing to think about.
Got it.
I mean, another solution is part of the issue is I have it right at the back of my desk because I have a like a standing desk thing, like, you know, just one that sits on the top. So all the cables do hang all the way down, basically can go all the way down to the floor. I bet you if I moved it over to, you know, something where the cables went down, but were still supported at the bottom, I could take some of that pressure off those cables too. So
that makes sense. Yeah, that checks out. Yeah. All right.
Should I take us to Bruce?
Let's do Phil.
Okay.
You want to read Phil, please, Adam? I know I'm jumping around.
Yeah, let me make sure I got that. I don't know if I had that one queued up. Oh no, I did.
Okay, great. Cool.
Yeah, Phil's asking about sounds like ad blockers. He says, which ad blocker do I use to replace vinegar? So I guess he's using an ad blocker that's no longer supported or has run out of utility, whatever it might be. But he was using an ad blocker called Vinegar. What do we recommend as an ad blocker?
So I answered that one, and I came up with a couple. There's uBlock Origin, which is for Mac OS only, and so all of our listeners can use that. It's a free ad blocker, and it's available for Firefox, that's easy for me to say, and Chromium-based browsers, but not Safari. And for Safari, there's AdGuard. It blocks YouTube ads and other web ads without needing additional extensions. And as always, remember that ad blockers can break the site. And most of them are anymore, it seems, tell you, hey, you need to turn off ad blocker. But if your site appears to be broken for no apparent reason, remember that you might have an ad blocker on. So disabling it may help fix that. And then without trying to be a judgmental SOB, content creators rely on ads for their revenue and that sort of thing. That being said, Google Ads was so aggressive on our site that after I reached my initial threshold to get the first check from them, I disabled Google Ads because it was so intrusive and so nasty on our website that I went, I don't want that to be, you know, it ruined the experience for visitors to the site. And so I disabled it, but
I wouldn't blame Google Ads for that. I would blame, that you get to control how Google Ads displays on your site. Now, you were probably doing it with a WordPress plugin and left it to its default settings. And yep. and I 100% agree that that is way more aggressive than anything I would ever want to see on a website. But you could, okay. A, you could use that plugin and temper it, but also you can just take the code and build it into your templates exactly where you want those ads to appear and do it in a way that, in my opinion, can be done tastefully. And so sure. Even as, you know, someone who certainly made a good chunk of my living from display ads on the web for a very long time, the ad blocker thing is, it's not cut and dry for me. Because I have one. I use one blocker and I don't have it on all the time, but there are certain sites where I have to turn it on because otherwise it's non-functional.
The site's broken without
the site's broken with the ads. Now I also understand, I don't want to get too far on a soapbox here, but I understand that it is up to the content creator how they choose to deliver ads to their users. And then the user's decision is either accept the content with the ads that the creator put in or don't accept the content with the ads the creator put in. And because we always used to say at Mac Observer, you know, the site's not free. The price to read our content is to look at the ads we choose to show you. Or to at least let us display the ads we choose to show you. Whether you actually look at them or not is that's a whole other conversation. Sure. But and so I get that there's nuances here. I mean, it's the same with the show. People ask me routinely. They're like, "You do chapters for your show, right?" I'm like, "Yeah." And by the way, if you didn't know, we do chapters for our show. so if like you don't want to hear this discussion, you just skip this chapter and boom, you're on to the next thing. And you're welcome to do that. People are shocked when I tell them, well, yeah, of course I put chapters around each of our ads. Like, they're like, well, doesn't that let people skip them more easily? I'm like, yep, it sure does. Because that's the experience I would want. Not that I'm going to skip every ad, but if I've heard it before, if I already own, and of course I couldn't because it's not out yet, but if I already own the OWC Thunderbolt 5 hub, well, I don't need to hear an ad about it. So I'm sold. It worked, you know, right? So I can skip and move on. It's fine. As far as I'm concerned, you folks are welcome to do that. Of course, if Pete and Adam disagree, then we have to go have a conversation and come up with a new set of instructions for everyone.
Let me offer something. I can't tell you how many times I still listen to say a 1Password ad because I learned about new features.
Exactly.
And, you know, so I listen to the ads and then, you know, your ads, and I try to do the same thing on my show is make them clever, make them funny, make them engaging so that people want to listen to them.
And informative. Like, I love it when we have ads that can just be content or content adjacent. We'll never try and hide the fact that someone is sponsoring the show. At least we never have. I can't imagine we would ever, any of the three of us would ever choose to make that decision.
Yeah.
But except I can see Adam over there shifting in his seat. I think he's been paid. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm shifting in my seat because I do have some things to add to this. Yeah. And I think you guys are hitting on the key point where, especially for content that is ad supported, there is a contract between three parties. It's the advertiser, it is the content creator, and it is the consumer of said content, right? And we all have to be respectful of each of these contracts and each of these relationships and not take advantage on any given side of it, right? So there's an exchange between all of us, basically. And I think where people want to start to use ad blockers is when that any side of that relationship is being abused, most specifically like the content side. Like, we're delivering you content, in exchange we're going to give you as much as possible relevant, useful ads. We're not going to put 27 of them in a 30-minute show, you know, that sort of thing. And so the websites where I end up using blockers, and I agree, one blocker is one that I love. And just to give another recommendation, on my wife's computer, I think we used Ghostery for a long time, which is another great one. I think that one might even be open source, if I'm remembering. OneBlocker has a free option, but they also have a paid option. So I think I actually purchased OneBlocker. I can't remember if it's a subscription or not, but doesn't matter. There's a lot of options. But when I enable those is when I get to a website, like you were saying, Pete, where it's just so egregious that it's actually detracting from the reason I'm there, which is to consume the content.
Right.
You know, I think during Fireball, John Gruber had a word for this. Like when they're throwing up D bars, and I'm, you know, doing that because family friendly, but basically a million ads where there's more ads than the content, or the ads are blocking the content. I'm blocking your ads because I'm there for the content. Right.
I have left
so
podcasts.
That's the contract. That's the relationship. It's just like, don't be a jerk. I'm happy to see a couple ads and let you get your revenue. But if it's actually taking away from the main reason why I'm there, then you screwed up.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
And that's your fault. And I don't feel bad about blocking your ads.
Yeah. When 40% of your show is ads, not interested anymore. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yep. Only 39.5, Pete. That's our right. limit here.
Right on. But when it's the same ad week after week after week without even changing the content of it, you know, I had a podcast I loved and I left it. I just like, I can't do this anymore.
Yep.
What are you going to do?
We're going to move on to David's question.
Add chapters. They could have added chapters and let you skip it and then maybe you would have stayed.
Yep.
Right? Yeah. So, okay. David's question. We can do that. David has some fist shakes, as I recall.
That's correct.
I have two fist shakes, both fists, at Microsoft. Could you tell me how to delete fonts, Aptos and MS Copilot? I asked for neither, and I hate. Oh, that's a strong word. I hate both of them.
Wow.
Thanks, David.
We don't. We want to help you remove hate from your life, David. So let's see if we can get there.
Hate is not welcome here.
No, it really isn't. Yeah, but we're going to help you. So go launch the. There is an app on your Mac called Fontbook. I believe it's in Applications Utilities, but I candidly don't know. I just fire up Spotlight and look for Fontbook. Launch Fontbook. Filter for the fonts in question. I mean, or you can just scroll through the list and find them. It doesn't matter. Right click on the font there. And if the remove option is not grayed out, you're off to the races. Remove it and you're done. If that option is grayed out, however, there is another option that will help you. It is show in Finder. That will pull up the actual font file in the Finder and you can delete from there. You might need to reboot your Mac afterwards, see if it just magically disappears from Fontbook when you do that. But that should do it. And if you have trouble deleting from there, let us know what your Mac says. Feedback at MacGeekab.com and we'll help. So
the terminal is your friend then.
Yeah, probably the terminal is your friend then. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I don't know if there's ever a situation where deactivate is an option where remove isn't. I would imagine they're always both there. So the difference there obviously is one's going to actually remove or delete the font from your system entirely. If you just want to temporarily disable it, thinking that maybe someday I want to get this font back, you can deactivate the font in Fontbook and then at some point come back and reactivate it if you want.
Yeah.
So
I haven't looked in a long time. How much space does a font take? On average, is it a few kilobytes, a few megabytes?
I think it's a few megabytes. Yeah.
Okay.
They're not. It's going to depend on the font set and how many variations it has and a number of factors. Because I mean, they're collections a lot of times.
Because there's tons and tons. And how many does anyone ever really use? I mean, if you're going to be creative, you're going to want to be able to go through 50, 60, 80 fonts, 100 fonts. But
well, maybe. I think part of the problem is like, if you have an egregious list, you know, like 500 fonts,
it makes it harder.
That little drop down menu can be hard to like get through. And it also can take some time to load if it's like actually rendering the font. So like, you know, font management is a thing. Like it's like if you don't need 300 fonts, you know, you might want to turn off a bunch of them. If you know, I only use 12 fonts on a regular basis because all I'm doing is writing emails and doing, you know, some simple Word documents, then you can get crazy.
I will point out that there are
back, right?
Yes, you can add them back. I will point out that there are some fonts. The two he mentioned are not system fonts, but there are some fonts that are system fonts that you cannot remove, or at least cannot easily remove. And we don't recommend that you figure out a way to, but these third party fonts, like these two Microsoft fonts you mentioned, are not, they're not on my system. So I can fairly confidently say that they are not system fonts, and you should, in theory, be able to remove them. So, but yeah, if it's a system font, maybe don't remove that. You might live to regret it. Yeah.
I'm actually surprised Clean My Mac doesn't have a font manager in it.
Yeah. I think we're allowed to say
feature suggestion.
I think that we're allowed to say that Clean My Mac, that Space Lens is very high on the list of features that they are looking at implementing in the new Clean My Mac. I think that's accurate based on what we saw at
my
CES.
Impression was they were kind of surprised by that. Was that your impression, Dave?
It could be. I wasn't sure how to read too, them either, because we're talking to different people and not necessarily the engineering team. But it seemed like they might have been caught flat-footed by that. Yeah. Which is odd. Like,
This is far more used than we thought. So,
but don't they have data on that? Like, I would assume, I don't know. I would assume there'd be aggregated data, but maybe not.
It's one of those things, Dave. I think that, you know, when things are going well, no one says a thing. And when things go to crap, people write in and go, hey.
Well, but that's the thing. Is that their data, or do they actually have data on how we use the app? Like, if they do, then they would have known how many people use Space Lens. But I don't know. Anyway.
Hey, a couple more really quick tips for font book. So I think you were talking about system fonts versus non-system fonts. There is in the sidebar something called My Fonts, which I'm pretty sure are the ones that were installed by you and not the system. So if you want to see a collection of just the ones that you've added, I think you can use that My Fonts tab. And then the other tip is FontBook also has the ability to create collections. So just think of it like an album out of your, you know, photos, where you're just taking a subset of certain fonts. I think there's some default ones. Like, I have one called Fun, Modern, PDF, Traditional, Web. I think those are recreated, but you can create your own. So if you want to create a set of fonts, like, you know, hey, I have a set of fonts that I used for this one project or something like that, you can create a collection, throw them all in there, and then you can right click and deactivate a entire set. So if you know, I'm only going to use this a few times a year, you know, when I'm doing Christmas cards, it's a bunch of Christmas fonts or comic book fonts that I did for some project fun thing. You could throw them in a collection and then deactivate them when you're done with them, and then they won't be showing up and everything. And then when you need them back, you can go activate the whole collection.
Yeah, they're right there in the sidebar. Right click it and deactivate fonts in Fun is the name of the group, or, you know, whatever. That's cool, Adam.
Good stuff.
Brilliant.
Yeah, I like it. Sweet. Do we have more on that?
Oh, man.
I feel like we've got
that's
a couple
all I got.
Minutes left.
That's all I got. I mean, there are smart collections, too, if you want to get really, really crazy. Like, I created one for monospaced fonts because I use those for programming. So I just want to be able to find and see all my available monospaced fonts to turn on and off. And those work just like smart albums, where you can set up a criteria of font properties like italic or bold or monospace or whatever you want. And then it'll automatically put those into a little collection.
There you go. Cool. Where are we on time?
CSS?
Yeah, we got time for Cool Stuff Found. I wanted to point out that Sonos now supports lossless streaming of Apple Music. So in order to do this, you go in, I'll put a link in the show notes, but you have to go in and turn off Atmos streaming so that you just get the lossless stereo stream of the music. So they've now added that to Sonos, and there's a list of players. It's basically not the super old players, because they just don't have the capability of doing lossless audio, but otherwise. Yeah. And Sonos also has a new CEO, Tom Conrad, as of, I think, last week. And I've known Tom for a long time, and I think he's a good person to kind of take that team and lead it back to where it needs to be. So I'm I'm hopeful of Sonos's future reliability. We'll see.
Nice.
We'll see when we get
nice.
There.
But I'm wondering, is there a website that you could go to compare lossless versus compressed?
I mean, you can do it in Apple Music. You can just tell it.
Oh, okay.
You probably won't be able to hear the difference between 256K AAC and lossless 24-bit sound. And there's a lot of reasons for that that include the speakers you're listening on, the way the music was mixed and mastered, so much stuff. The way that it's mixed is mixed because it is built to be streamed with compressed audio. So there's a whole lot of reasons that it's very, even for me, I've trained myself to hear the difference, but when I say that, I don't say it globally. There are specific sections of specific songs where I know, okay, I can hear there's a little more tail of the reverb on the uncompressed version versus the compressed version, but I can't say that it's better. I can just point to it and say, I know that is, so Spotify, I can tell. Gosh. Spotify sounds awful. And I don't know why that is. No, it's weird because it's 320K.
You don't have something nice to say, Dave.
It's bizarre. Like they've somehow gone out of their way to make it sound worse than it should because it's 320K MP3s, which should be undetectably fabulous. Different. Correct. Yeah. And yet they figured out a way. It just sounds flat. It must be the compression algorithm that they're using is just not one of the better ones. I guess. I don't know. It's bizarre to me, but I can tell when I'm listening most of the time. Again, not globally, but it's like, oh yeah, is this Spotify? Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Moving on.
I got one.
Go.
Yeah. So my spoon is too big. Wrote in with a story about basically they think saving their dog's life. It was well below freezing. And the dog wandered off as a rescue, which is why they got it. And even though Apple recommends not attaching an AirTag to your dog, there is now an AirTag dog collar mount. And these are the points. We'll put the link in the show notes for it. But secure and comfortable, IP69, so it's waterproof. Dogs can swim with it. Works with any width collar or harness, and up to 0.2 inches thick or 5 millimeters thick. So if the collar is thicker than almost a quarter inch, then it'll be a problem. But that's still pretty thick. Durable composite construction, fits dogs and cats over about 10 pounds, smaller than that. It's pretty big on their neck, but it'll still work. It doesn't dangle, so that's the main thing. It's the through the collar design. It keeps it from dangling. And then front screws let you change the AirTag battery without taking it off the collar. And here's the big one: unconditionally guaranteed for life. Any issues, and they'll make it right. So,
This is from Elevation Lab. This is we just talked about their stuff. I think in a cool stuff found in the last couple of weeks somewhere, but yeah.
Yeah, because they have like a stick-on fabric one that you can put inside a bag or inside a jacket.
And were they the ones that also made the 10-year one too, or am I confused?
Oh, that's right. We brought that one up too. That long-term battery. Yeah, they have an external battery for an AirTag. I think I brought that one up. I mean, go to that website. They have AirTag things for everything. They have bike mounts. They have specific tool mounts. Like they even have a specific one for like if you have specifically Makita. Like drilled in saws and stuff like that. It's like color matched to their red color. And like, so they have AirTag solution for everything.
Huh. Cool. Cool.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Including your pets.
Yeah. No, they make good stuff. All right. I heard, my friend Shannon that I do Business Brain with, I asked him one day, I was like, what webcam are you using? Because he looks really good. I was like, are you using continuity camera? And he says, no. He said, I found this thing called the Insta360 Link camera. It's $180 at Amazon right now. And it's got it's got smarts in it. They call it AI smarts. Okay, fine. But it will do the face tracking and all of that. The image quality of it was really impressive. I've been saying for years that really the best webcam you can buy is a used iPhone and use either Continuity Camera or Reincubates Camo or something. Yeah. But this one seems to, I haven't used it personally other than with him to do shows, but it looks really good. It's a clear picture that, and it's a 4K camera. No, I don't know that that matters for a lot of things right now, but I was impressed. For $180. It's pretty good.
So, it's cheaper than a phone.
Exactly.
This is that company that makes really like high end cameras and like action GoPro style cameras. I think the same company, right?
I think you're right.
Insta360.
So we're getting the benefits
of that. Does it do that globe thing? Because people do that. I think they have that globe effect too, right? Where it makes it look like you're on a planet.
Yeah.
That effect, like yeah, that everybody does.
He's
where
got
you put it on a stick, and
he yeah. said he likes the software for it. I haven't dug deep into it, but yes, I think it has all those effects too.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Like I know they have a professional like VR cameras that do like the full 60 like VR for like VR headsets and stuff like
right.
that. They're like they look like a thing out of Star Wars, like one of those Star Wars drones, droids with like cameras all the way around and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool company. So it's not surprising they make a really good webcam.
Yeah. Well, you're right. Now that you mention it, the fact that they have these higher end cameras means that they're able to spend, like Apple is able to spend more money on R&D than someone who is only making a $179 camera could. Right. And if they let that tech trickle down into all of their products, well, now that's why the iPhone is such a great web camera, because there's hundreds of millions of dollars put into the smarts R&D. In that camera. Yeah, it's hard to compete with that. So
well, and they care about the lenses and the optics, and you know, so they're on that higher end of,
and like, all the computational photography, right? Like, so both
exactly,
of those
yeah.
things together. Yeah, exactly.
Very cool.
All right. I think that's it.
I think we
succeeded. At least I hope we succeeded. I hope we recorded this. This was a pretty good
one. Did you hit the record button, Dave?
No, I thought you were doing that, Pete.
Oh, boy.
Dave's got the local recording.
Oh, yeah. We have local recordings. That's right. Yes. Thank goodness for that. Thank goodness for all of you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for sending in all your stuff as you always do. Thanks for being a part of the Mac Geek Gab community. It's really an amazing honor that we get to continue to do this week in and week out. So thank you for that. Thanks to CashFly for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. Make sure to check out the other podcasts that we do. Adam's got his debut film podcast, or the debut film podcast. It's not called his.
Yeah.
It's called the. Pete's got So There I Was, and I've got Business Brain and Gig Gab, which is the latter being the reason that I'm out here in Anaheim at NAMM in the first place. So thanks for hanging out, and we'll see you next week. Next week's show will be released one day late. It's just because of our travel schedule, but it will be out. Tuesday the 4th is when it's coming.
You got a mouse in your pocket? I'm not traveling.
Maybe I do. I don't know. I haven't checked my pockets. I've been doing this show. So, but check your pockets, because if you have a mouse in your pocket, you don't get caught with that. That's a bad.
No.
Maybe. I don't know. I've never had a mouse in my pocket. What do I know?
Mice. A mouse.
Nobody has mouse, Pete.